Hi, everybody. I'm Mike Allison, and I'm an alcoholic. Everybody having a good time? How about up there in the club level seats? I love that. All right. People have signs and stuff. Oh, man, what a beautiful morning to be sober. I'm so happy to be here at the North Coast Roundup. This is the second time I've come to Oregon in as many years, and you have a beautiful state. And it's full of beautiful, wonderful, friendly people. You really, it's just been awesome. Thank you. My sobriety date is February the 12th, 1990. And my home group is the Brentwood Full Moon Group in Brentwood, Tennessee. It's just south of Nashville. We howl at the moon. We never take ourselves too seriously. And that's always been my home group. We meet on Friday nights at 6:30. We have a big open discussion meeting. We also have a newcomers meeting, and we also have an open speaker meeting the last Friday of the month. We also have an Alateen and Al-Anon meeting down the hallway. Our group is 30 years old this past year, and the Al-Anon meeting started not too long after the Full Moon group did. We've moved four different times, and the Al-Anons have moved with us every time, and I'm so grateful for that because this lady that I'm married to, it's right here on the front row, my wife Diane, has been a member of Al-Anon for 25 years, and I'm so grateful for Al-Anon. I want to thank Harlan for inviting Diane and I to come up here this weekend. It's just been an awesome treat. Thank you for the rest of all the committee and everybody that's volunteered to make this such a special weekend. It's just been unreal. The hospitality here has just been, it's just been unreal. We've felt so loved here. Thanks for John and Jen for picking us up at the airport and get us over here, and for Teresa for chairing today. And every time I'd look around somewhere, she'd be there and say, do you need anything? So I appreciate somebody offering that love and hospitality. Thanks to Zan for the video presentation last night. That was, boy, that was so touching. That was, wow. And thanks for T-Mar for recording this. When I was new, of course, we didn't have cassettes then. Didn't have CDs. It was all cassettes. And my sponsor would just hand me cassettes and say, listen to this. He didn't say, do you want to listen to this guy? He'd say, listen to this, you know. And I'd plug it in and listen to it. And it really saved me, particularly the first year, because I just had this Grand Central head that was going on all the time. And a lot of times today, I can plug a CD in my dash, and that's the voice that's louder than my head at the time. So carrying the message by recordings has been great, and so thank you so much for your service. And also, I want to thank all the rest of the speakers that they keep saying they raise the bar all the time. Well, you had a spiritual breakfast. That's probably the best thing you're going to get today. But I want to say thanks to Madeline and Cliff and Butch and Steve and Edith for everything that they shared. Gave me a little charge for my battery this weekend. I just love coming to roundups because I just get all, it's information overload, but it's all great information, and it inspires me to stay here another day. And also to Larsine and Nell, the Al-Anon speakers. I had a difficult time listening to Al-Anon speakers early on because we had some stuff still going on in our house, and I couldn't hear that side of the story, and I found out, you know, through listening to Diane's Al-Anon talk, she didn't care much for AA speakers either, because we laugh at all the wrong places. But I love Al-Anon. I love what it's done for me. I want to tell you about my wife. We met when I was in my last year in college, and my drinking was getting out of hand then, but it wasn't as bad as it got, as I'll tell you later. But she and I met, and we just partied and had a good time. And then, you know, I found out after a while, she just wanted to manage me a little bit too much. You know, she had this little control issue she had. And so I just broke it off with her for about a year and a half, or for a year, rather. We dated about a year and a half, and I broke up with her for about a year. But I had to get my wisdom teeth out, and they gave me a whole bunch of drugs to, you know, take my wisdom teeth out. And so I get this guy to take me back home from the oral surgeon, and I'm just loaded on these drugs, and I can't talk. And he said, look, I got to get back to work. He said, you know, you want me to call somebody to come over to your apartment? And so I just write on this napkin, call Diane, you know, wrote down her work number. And this guy didn't know we'd been broken up for a year. So he just calls her up and says, "Hey, Diane, this is George, and Mike's had his wisdom teeth out. He wants you to come take care of him." And this guy, and she's thinking, "George who? Mike who?" I mean, she's living with another guy at the time. And but she came over that day, and I started writing sideways on this napkin, "I love you, I want you back, you know, move in with me," all that stuff. And she did, and we've been together ever since then. And every March 18th, we celebrate Tooth Day, because that's the anniversary of me getting my wisdom teeth out. And this past March 18th was the 40th anniversary of Tooth Day. And I tell you that story mostly because I'm in my mid-20s by that time, and I have to be under the influence of something to be honest and get over the pride and fear I had to tell this woman I really loved and I wanted in my life. And I was already dependent. I didn't realize it, but I was already dependent on drugs and alcohol to do something for me, to make me okay, to make me feel normal. And it went downhill from there. Well, not for a while. A couple months later, I got high again, and I just looked at her, and I said, "Let's get married." So we got married after that. And, you know, my parents drank a lot. I grew up in a drinking home. I didn't think much of their drinking. You know, they drank after work, and they drank on the weekends to celebrate and party, and it seemed like they were having a good time. And every now and then, somebody would overshoot the mark, and bad things would happen. You know, there'd be arguments and fights and all that kind of stuff. And I thought, well, you know, they just overshot the mark. They shouldn't drink so much. You know, they're doing really well when they drink just enough where they're having fun. So when I started drinking, I went out with some older boys one time, and I overshot the mark the first time. And I was having a pretty good time still. I started throwing up everywhere I knew was possible in my house and out the window in my house. And my mother thought I had some kind of virus, so I got by with it. But, you know, I woke up the next day, and I thought, you know, I felt horrible. And I thought, why did I drink all this gin these guys gave me? But it did something for me. I was having a great time before I, you know, went into a blackout and started throwing up and got sick. And so I spent the next 25 years trying to not overshoot the mark so much and just get it right. Sometimes I got it right, and alcohol worked for me and just made me okay. I was a person that was restless and irritable and discontented as far back as I can remember. And I just felt like I didn't fit. You know, I had two older sisters that loved me and took care of me, but I got estranged from them after a while. You know, one of the first things my sponsor asked me, he said, "What's the opposite of love?" And I said, "Well, it's hate." And he said, "No, the opposite of love is indifference." And when I first got sober, I started realizing how indifferent I'd been to a lot of people in my life. I'd push people that loved me away because I felt like I was different and I wanted to be different. So I pushed a lot of people out of my life. One of the things I've had to learn here is to let people love me, you know, and accept help. And before I forget about that on that line, I celebrate 25 years on February the 12th, and I know this is just one day at a time deal, and I do this one day at a time, and I keep it simple, but for some reason that 25-year milestone was just overwhelming for me. I just can't believe I've stayed sober this long. And I started thinking about all the people that have helped me along the way. And so I started writing a few thank you notes to everybody that has really helped me, because I realized I never could have done this by myself. Through the grace of God and putting all the right people in my life at the right time loving on me is the reason why I'm standing up here. And so I start writing these thank you notes, and 64 thank you notes later, that's when I stopped writing. And I didn't have 64 people that I could call on before I got here. So I'm real grateful for all the people in my life. And Alcoholics Anonymous has allowed me to put, it's given me an opportunity to be the kind of husband and father and brother and grandfather and friend that I always wanted to be. But my alcoholism got in the way. So aside from this wonderful lady I'm married to, we had a couple of sons. And they're now 37 and 33. One lives in Nashville, and one lives in a yurt in the redwoods of Northern California, where he's been about 12 and a half years now. And he lives a wonderful life. It's not the path I would choose for him, but he's a wonderful man. And my son in Nashville is married. He's on his second marriage. His first marriage didn't work out. But we didn't divorce her because they got divorced. You know, she's very much a part of our life. And they produced my granddaughter, who gave me this tie for Christmas. I love my granddaughter. She is my Rule 62. Grandparenthood is just wonderful. I never had a grandfather, and now I get to be one. And she's 14, almost 15 now. And we still read Dr. Seuss and clown around. But, you know, if she wants to have ice cream for breakfast, yeah, let's do it. You know, it's just, grandparenthood is just unreal. And I have really good relationships with both my sons today as adult children, and I have really good relationships with both my sisters, even though they live out of state. I really have to work at that, you know. I have to reach out to people. But I have good relationships with both my sisters today. So my family has been repaired and restored because of Alcoholics Anonymous. And a lot of what I want to tell you today is, you know, I have a story of redemption and forgiveness. I'm going to tell you a lot about my next door neighbor, Mr. Logan, as I'm up here today. I think it's maybe fitting for what I'm supposed to do up here today. When I got out of school, I got in a family business that I was destined to be in, and I went to work, and my father drank like I did, and he and I didn't get along too well, but not long after I'd gone to work for this business, and Diane and I were together, and I'm raising this young family, my dad leaves for about 4 years to take a commitment that he had accepted, and he came back about 4 years later and wanted back in the business, and by then I thought I'd taken it over, and I wouldn't let him back in, and we just fought, and it was just awful. So I started building this resentment against this man who had sent me to the best schools that somewhere I was asked to leave from, and I didn't excel at anywhere I went. I was one of those guys that started out great. I remember they used to say, Michael has great potential, and I'd take that as a compliment. But that means you hadn't done anything yet. I didn't know that. But I'm in this family business, and I learned that I could work hard because I wanted to play hard. I mean, I'm the wild guy, drive fast, music cranked up to 11, you know, bring it on, the party guy. But I wanted to work really hard because that gave me the money I needed to keep up this lifestyle I was building. Plus, it got me some respect from my dad because he worked all the time too, and that's the only time I saw him. So I'm working for this family business, and I'm not getting along with my father. And as my drinking and my drugging progresses, which I went to college in the late 60s, and all of a sudden there were drugs everywhere, so I decided to try all those. And I'm an alcoholic, but I'll take whatever you got to supercharge my alcoholism. But what really carries the message for me is a good shot of Crown Royal. But I'll take everything else on top of that, or if I'd get to where I'd get in trouble or get too sick or something, I'd say, well, I need to cut back on my drinking, but my drug use would always go up this way. So I'm kind of rocking along. I'm drinking and drugging and working like crazy and just trying to pound my way through life. I start having all this depression and anxiety. So I start going to my doctor, and he starts prescribing all these tranquilizers for me. And eventually, as my depression increased, he gave me some antidepressants. So I'm taking these antidepressants and these things to slow me down. And I've got migraine headaches by now, so he's got me a prescription for painkillers. So I'm taking those, and I'm washing all that down with the street drugs and Crown Royal I've got, and trying to pound my way through things. And it's not working very well. I start doing some really bizarre things. I was in the landscaping business back then, and Diane and I bought a house way up on top of this really high ridge. It's one of the highest houses in the whole county around surrounding Nashville area. And it's a long dead-end street, and all the people on the street have really nice views because of the elevation in their backyards, but most of them don't have any landscaping at all. They just have their houses in the woods. It's just a rural area, rustic area. But not me. I'm in the landscaping business, and I think I'm this big shot at the time, and I'm going to show off all my landscaping expertise. And by the way, Larsine, you're not going to like this part. I heard you say yesterday you love trees. You might just want to go on to the airport now. Anyway, so I'm trying to have all this landscape in my yard, and I can't grow grass in my front yard because I've got all these trees in my yard. And, the leaves would shade out my grass, and then in the fall, the leaves would fall on the grass and choke it out, and I'd have to redo it. So I'm thinking, well, I'm just going to cut all my trees down. You know, that way I can have this nice landscaping and show off what a big shot I am. That might have been a pretty good plan. That was my choice to do that, but I really didn't know. I wasn't sure where my property line was on one side of it. I knew where it was up at the street, but our lot goes way down this steep hill. I mean, we've lived there since 1976, and I've only been down there two or three times because it's straight up and down. But I think I need to find my property line, so I go wandering down this hillside with my plat where I bought my house and a compass, and I'm going to find my property line. Well, I find this iron stake in the ground down in the woods, and I convince myself that's my property line. So then I call a surveyor up, and I said, look, I can't even see this my house from where this stake is on the hillside. I want you to come over here and mark this line for me. And these guys came over, and they looked at it, and I remember saying a couple times, they said, we don't think this is right. But you see, I'm an alcoholic. I have this laser beam focus. When I make up my mind, I'm right. And if I'm paying you, you do it my way. So these guys said, okay. So they start. And by the way, I found out since I got sober that if you need a property line found, you can just call a surveyor and tell them you need to find the line, and they'll come do it for you. You don't even have to tell them where you think it is. So these guys come out, and they start putting these stakes in the ground like I told them to and lining it up with this lot line at the street. And when the stakes and flags come up the hill, when they got between our houses, these stakes and flags were almost touching my next-door neighbor's house. Now, a sane person would have thought, well, maybe these surveyor guys are right, but not me. I'm thinking, that old goat, he's been using my property all this time. He built his house right up on the line, and he's just been claiming some of my land. And I wasn't about to wait until he got back from Florida where he was with his wife to discuss it with him because I want these trees cut down and I'm right and I don't have any communication skills and my alcoholism is just like a freight train at this point in time. So I get a friend of mine that has a tree surgery company and they come up there with two bucket trucks and a whole bunch of chainsaws and they cut all these trees down. And it was a lot of trees. According to a jury of my peers, it was $50,000 worth of trees because he wasn't happy with my surveying when he got home, and he sued me successfully, and he should have. And he asked for a jury trial because he was so upset about it. This is Mr. Logan, and he sued me for $50,000, and I had to sit through a two-day jury trial while his attorney just, And I'm sitting there, and I had a three-piece suit on that I'd sweated all the way through it. Remember that old vodka funky smell? Sweat. I've sweated all the way through this three-piece suit because I'm trying to act dignified in this courtroom like, how could this be happening to me? And I'm eating these blue Valiums I had during the recess to try to act calm while his attorney just portrayed me as a lunatic for cutting all these trees down. So after 2 days, the jury awarded him the $50,000, and they gave him $5,000 more punitive damages that he didn't ask for, and I didn't like that either. So by this time, I'm convinced that, my alcoholism makes me turn it around where everything's your fault. By this time, I'm saying, well, I just made a mistake. It could have happened to anybody. I didn't mean to cut your trees down, and you overreacted. So I'm mad at this guy because he has sued me and embarrassed me and cost me this money. And so every day when I'd pull in my driveway, I'd see his house and I'd get mad before I even went in to see my wife and my sons. Every day for years, I'd hate this guy before I'd walk in and see my family. If I'd see him on the street, I'd ease my car over in his lane like I was playing chicken with him. And I'd curse at him when he'd go out and get his mail if I was out there. I was just horrible to this man. And what I didn't know, my wife would, these were wonderful people. We were friends before I did this. But I thought he had wronged me. But Diane would take our sons over there during the day and visit with he and his wife. And they stopped going after I did that. And I never realized I was doing that. You know, Diane has said in her Al-Anon talk that, that's before she was an Al-Anon, and she would still have a relationship with these people today if I did something like that. But she didn't, and she sided with me. Well, it wasn't so bad that I did those things to him. A couple of years before, when we were still friends, he came to me one time and he said, "I know you're in the landscaping business. My wife has always loved weeping cherry trees. Can you get her one of those?" I said, "Sure, I can do that. What else you want?" He said, "Well, I don't know." And I said, "Well, go ask her if she wants anything else. You know, I'm this big shot guy." He came back a day or two later, and she wanted a couple of other shrubs of some kind. So I send one of my crews out and get this big weeping cherry tree and these other plants. And I asked the guy where he was going to plant it, and he told me. So I sent my crew up there and planted it and planted the other things for him. And he came over to my house. He said, "Gosh, I really appreciate you doing this, but, I only wanted to get this because you're my neighbor and you're in that business. I wanted to give you the business." He said, "How much do I owe you?" And I remember holding my chest out and saying, "Oh, you don't owe me anything. It's like, look at me. Look what a big shot I am. I don't need your money. You know, I've got my people here. Thank God y'all are my people now." But I thought I had my people that I could, send him up there and plant this tree and everything. And so I wouldn't let him pay me. Well, after he sued me, the very next night, I went over there with some herbicide and put on that weeping cherry tree and killed it. I can always tell how many Al-Anons are in the crowd. Because they go, "Oh," and alcoholics go, "Ha, ha, ha." And I'm your spiritual speaker today. Oh, man. My life was coming apart by then. My drinking and drugging changed. The daily reflections today, if I can find that in here, daily reflections on April 12th really sums this up where it goes from here. It said, "Where alcohol was involved, we have been strangely insane. Alcoholism required me to drink whether I wanted to or not. Insanity dominated my life and was the essence of my disease. It robbed me of the freedom of choice over drinking and therefore robbed me of all other choices. When I drank, I was unable to make effective choices in any part of my life, and life became unmanageable. I asked God to help me understand and accept the full meaning of the disease of alcoholism. My life went downhill from there. I started cheating on my wife. I had this woman that just loved me dearly. But my disease told me that I just need to go out there and get a little wilder. I knew it was wrong when I was doing it, and I continued to do it. I don't like talking about this part of my story, but Diane and I have always been open about that from our talks because we know that we're not the only ones that happens to. And after I got sober, one of the first amends that I had to make was to my wife. And I'll tell you about it later how I loused it up the first time. It took a long time to undo that damage. But I want you to know that that was a long time ago, and I've got a marriage that's built on trust, and I work real hard trying to honor that and keep that intact. But my life was unraveling. I was doing things that compromised all the values that I ever had. All the things I loved, I was hating. And I got so angry with my father one time that he was coming out to my office after he said he'd retired and was wanting to help me. And one time he came out there, and I was so angry because he'd come out there and just bother me, I thought. And I brought my shotgun to work. I was going to shoot his Buick when he drove up there. I thought if I shot the windows and tires out of his Buick, he'd get the message that I didn't want him around. Yeah. And when I came home and I told Diane what I was thinking about doing, she said, you need some help. And so I go see my doctor one more time, and I tell him, I said, "Look, I don't know whether you're going to put me in a nut house or what, but I was going to assassinate my father's Buick this morning, and He said, well, go see this lady. And so he sent me to a psychologist. And this was on the following Monday I set up where I was supposed to go to this lady who was a psychologist. And I'd been to counselors and psychologists and even a psychiatrist all through my life from all my problems I was having, and they never seemed to do me any good. And at this point in time, as I said earlier, I'd quit every now and then. You know, I even quit drinking for 8 months one time. And I was telling everybody how good I felt and everything. And then I went off with my brother-in-law's to a baseball game in St. Louis, and I was actually their designated driver when I went up there. And after I got there, I wasn't. And somebody put a drink in front of me, and I just downed it without thought. I had no defense against the first drink. And I didn't know at that time that I had that obsession that I could trigger. So I go see this lady on a Monday. And so I quit drinking over the weekend. I thought, well, maybe I need to slow down on my drinking. This is after I go see my doctor. So I go see this lady. And so I go see her. I remember writing on my calendar that $90 for 75 minutes. And I thought, boy, I'm going to get to tell her what a rotten guy my father is, and my wife's on my back, and got these kids in private schools I can't afford, and blah, 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 because my business is not doing well at this point in time. So I go in there, and I sit down, and the first thing this lady said, I want to ask you a few questions before we start. I said, okay. And she said, how much do you drink? I said, I don't drink. And she said, you don't drink at all? And I said, no, ma'am. She said, well, did you ever drink? I said, yeah, used to. And she said, when did you quit? I said, Thursday. And I found an old calendar of mine later on that I actually quit on Friday. I guess if I thought I added a day to it, it'd sound like a lot longer. She said, well, before you quit drinking, how much did you drink? And I really don't know, because I never ran out. My resources never ran out, and I always had a supply everywhere I was, wherever I was. My old buddy Tom, who's coming up on 25 years sober, said I used to clink in the wintertime because I'd carry all these miniatures in my pocket, these little men. So I didn't know, but I told her as best I could how much I drank, as honestly as I could. And then she asked me something that just hit me. She said, do you take any drugs? And when she asked me that, it was like, I thought, man, I'm just tired of this whole thing. You know, it's a hard job being the lead drunk, my sponsor says. And I was leading this double life, you know, and I'm trying to stay as, you know, my idea of social drinking is drink as much as I can without slurring my words. I mean, I was trying to be a different person in every situation, and my life was just falling apart. I was 39 years old. And when she asked me that, I said, yeah, I do take some drugs. She said, well, what do you take? And I said, and I told her all the prescriptions that I had for the stuff I had. And then I told her all the things that I was getting from, I don't know what you call them, undocumented pharmacists. And so she said, do you have any drugs with you now? And I said, yes. And she said, what do you have with you? And I reached in my pocket and I pulled out my change and I started counting these pills that were loose in my change. And I had 37 blue volumes just loose in my change, and she thought that was a lot. But I'd quit drinking on Friday. I was a little jumpy, you know. I bought 100 of them. That's what I had left on Monday. And she said, before we go any further, I want you to have an addiction evaluation done. And I thought, man, I ain't even told you about my father yet. I got real problems here. So she sends me to another guy, and Diane goes with me, and we fill out some questionnaires, and then he talks to us individually, then he got us together. And he said, you know, these tests that you had here, these questions, it's not rocket science. He said, this is pretty standard stuff. He said, from what you've written down here, he said, you've been an alcoholic for at least 15 years, and if you don't get some help pretty soon, you're going to die. And the first thing that went across my mind was, how could you say that in front of my wife? You know, I don't know about any of you, but my ego will kill me trying to protect itself. I mean, that's the first thing I thought of. Not that my life was in jeopardy. And I said, well, what do you mean? He said, you need to go to treatment and you need to go to AA. And I'm thinking, well, I don't have time for that. You know, I'm busy. You know, I'm in the landscaping business, and it's been all winter, and I'm starving, and my, you know, this, all my people were almost gone. It was down to me and three other guys and one truck. And I said, look, I don't have time to do that. He said, man, if you don't do something about your drinking and drugging, he said, you're going to die. You don't have to worry about your business. And he said, you need to go to treatment. And Diane hadn't been to Al-Anon yet, and she said, well, what do I need to do? And he said, pack his bags. Well, I didn't like that either. And I said, look, I can't do that. I got to work. And he said, well, go see these people. They have an outpatient program. You can go 6 weeks and go at night, and you can work during the day. So they're closing the doors on me. So I said, oh, okay, I'll go talk to these people. In the next couple of days, I see all these. There, it seemed like there was treatment center billboards all over Nashville about that time. And I'd see them, and I'd look at them, and I'd think, you know, I'm not that bad. You know, I can quit on my own. You know, they just know I got good insurance. They just won't rip me off. I mean, I'd go from, I can't live another second feeling like I am, to, well, I'm not that bad. I just went like this, and I did that for quite a while. And as a matter of fact, it was about I was almost a year sober before I really thought, I did go to this outpatient program, and I really thought that I wasn't that bad because I didn't have to go inpatient. I was only an outpatient. I nipped this thing in the bud. And that's what I was telling myself. But the truth of the matter is I was just crazy as a loon. I got this loaded 9mm pistol in my pocket that I carry all the time, and I'm wanting to shoot a Buick, and I'm wanting to kill myself all the time. I was just a wreck. But then I think, well, I'm not that bad. But what I did, my sponsor took me to Memphis to hear Clancy when I was about 11 months sober, and I'm still struggling with this. Am I really powerless over alcohol? Because I think I could quit. But when I went to see this lady at the treatment center, she said, I said, look, I don't have time for this. And she said, just because you quit drinking doesn't mean you're going to quit hurting. And I thought, what does that mean? Because I thought if you quit drinking and quit doing drugs, then everything's going to be fine. That's my problem. But when my sponsor took me to hear Clancy, he said two things that night that just shook me to the core. He said, without recovery, the natural state of a sober alcoholic is growing depression and anxiety. And he said, the thing that makes alcoholism a fatal disease is that sobriety eventually becomes emotionally unbearable. And when he said that, I knew what I had. Because when I quit drinking and using, I feel worse. I get that itch inside I can't scratch. I'm so uncomfortable. I get angry. I get depressed. I'm at my worst when I'm just stark raving sober. You know, my problem is I've been sober. You know? And so I go see this lady at the treatment center. She's trying to get me to do this, and I'm saying, look, I know how to quit. I'll come back this fall. And she said, no, that's not going to help you. So I go home, and I tell Diane, I said, do you think if I go to this treatment thing, it'll help me with my father? And she said, yeah, I think it probably will. And, you know, the only reason why I asked her that is if it didn't work out, I'd have her to blame. You know, that's just how I operated without thought. So I go to this treatment center, and for the first time in my life, I think I did everything I was supposed to do. I mean, I was really, thank God for the gift of desperation that I had then. And I hope I never lose that. But I go to this treatment center, and they said that I had to go to 5 AA meetings a week. And I said, you mean 5 AA meetings? And they said, no, you mean 5 a week. And I said, man, I can't do that. I'm too busy. But I managed to do that here 25 years later because I've got to participate in my recovery. You know, I don't know about you guys, but I gotta build my life around my recovery. I don't get to build my recovery around my life when it's convenient. I just can't do it. So I start going. I find out about the Full Moon Group, and I decide to go to this meeting. So I go over there to this church where it was, and I pull in there, and a parking lot's full of cars. And I'm thinking, man, I've come on the wrong night for this A&A thing. You know, I think it's a couple of old guys in trench coats shaking and puking on each other. I don't know what AA is. I think it's the end of the line, you know. And I'm thinking, well, I've come on the wrong night. This church must be having some bazaar or revival or something, you know. But I'm kind of milling around in the parking lot. And there's other guy that's late, and he's coming the other direction. And he sees me, and he comes over to me. And he's this rock and roll singer that I'd always go see every time he performed in Nashville. And he said, can I help you? And I said, you're so-and-so. And he said, yeah. And I introduced myself to him. I said, man, I love your just love your voice, love to hear you play, you know, every time. And, you know, and I assumed he just was as fried as I was every time I'd go see him perform. So I'm thinking, what's this guy doing here? He must go to the church or something. I don't know. And he said, he kept badging me. He said, can I help you? And I'm stumbling around there. And I said, I heard there was an AA meeting here. And he said, yeah, mate, you're in the right place. And this guy opened the front door for me, and I found out he had 4 years of sobriety. It just floored me. And there I was out in the parking lot worried about somebody seeing me in an AA meeting. You know, and I parked my car in front of the front door of the Cockeyed Camel in Bellevue every day. Never thought about that, you know. So I go in the meeting, and they seemed to know I was new. And they did a first step meeting for me. And they gave me love, and they gave me hope. They gave me hope. That's what I get from AA. I get hope here. They did a first step meeting for me, and they went around the room, and they start telling their stories. And there's a guy in there named Joe W. Joe's passed on now. He's a great big guy. He's 6'6", and he used to call me Big Mike. He's looking at me. And he said he'd had 2 DUIs in one day. 2 different occasions. And I'm thinking to myself, I've never had a DUI. I'm not that bad. And the guy that's now my sponsor, Terry, said he would sleep with a pint of vodka. He said he was down to drinking that old cheap vodka. He said, you know you're drinking cheap vodka when it's all vowels. There's no C's and Z's. It's all C's and Z's and no vowels in it. And he said he'd sleep with a pint of vodka, and he'd wake up in the middle of the night shaking, and he'd have to reach under his pillow and crack the top on that pint, slug down about half of it to stop shaking, put the cap on, put it under his pillow where he could go back to sleep for a couple hours. And his alarm would go off, and he'd be shaking again, and he'd have to finish the pint off where he could shave and brush his teeth and go to work. And I'm thinking, I don't drink like that. I'm not that bad. And I'm sitting there with that loaded pistol in my pocket, and I'm a crazy man, but I'm thinking, well, I'm not as bad as these people. Well, some of the rest of them shared. I don't know what they shared. And it got to my turn, and they said, you have anything you want to say? And I said, well, I'm Mike. I don't know whether I'm an alcoholic or not, but I've been diagnosed with clinical depression. They laughed like y'all did. My grand sponsor said they wouldn't laugh so loud if they knew I had that pistol in my pocket that night. So be nice to newcomers. But they told me to keep coming back, and they gave me some phone numbers. And I fit in from then on. And the Full Moon Group's always been my home group. It was from day one. And so I finished this program. And before I finished this 6-week program, they said I had to get a sponsor before they'd let me out. And there was a guy named Buff who I thought must be president of AA because everybody loved him and talked to him. And he gave me his phone number that first night. So I thought, well, I'll ask him to be my sponsor. But when I'm sober, I'm real shy, and I don't like rejection. I don't like confrontation or conflict, any of that. So I went up to him after the meeting. I said, you know, Buff, I got to get a sponsor before I get out of treatment next week. That was my way of asking him. And he just looked at me and said, well, you ought to ask somebody, and walked off. So I went back the next time I saw him. I said, will you be my sponsor? And he said, yeah, I don't know much about finance or romance. He said, I've loused up a lot of that in my life. But he said, if you'll take the 12 steps with me like I took them with my sponsor, your life's going to change whether you want it to or not. And that's the best news anybody's ever given me. Everybody I've seen that's taken the 12 steps has gotten some good out of it. Their life's changed. There's nothing in the book designed to hurt anybody. The steps aren't punishment. And I had to remember that as I was going along doing a 4th and 5th step and making amends. This is not punishment. It's a way to freedom. It's a door to freedom for me. So I start following this guy around, and I'm little by little, I'm starting to go through the steps with him, you know. And how it works, it says it's some of these we balked. I balked at all of them. You know, I get a little relief, and then I want to know what the next step's going to do for me before I figure it out. You know, I tried to figure out what a 4-step was going to be like and do the perfect one for about 10 months, and it about killed me. You know, I did the first 3 steps. I wasn't sure I was powerless over alcohol at first, but, you know, my hair was unmanageable. My life was wrecked, so I knew that part. And I did need to be restored to sanity because I kept drinking when I shouldn't go start drinking again and was doing all these crazy things in my life. So I didn't have a problem with insanity. I ran away from God all my life, I suppose. My mother took me to church when I was a kid. As soon as I went off to college, I quit going and never went back for a long time. My parents would visit me at the University of Memphis, and I'd take them around town sightseeing, and we'd go by this big Catholic church, and I'd say, "That's where I go to Mass on Sunday." I'd never been in that church in my life. But I'd lie to them just to try to get their approval. Well, then I meet Diane, and we get engaged, and a nice priest counseled us. He was a really nice guy, so I went to church there for a while. And I'm not knocking the church, anybody. Please hear me out. It gives courage and directions to me, and it's what the book says, and it does for my wife. But I never seemed to fit in there for some reason. I just didn't get the message there. I hadn't yet. And so we get married, and then the priest moves away, and I leave the church again. And then I got resentful as things got worse because my wife spent a lot more time with her church because that's what was helping her the most in the midst of our chaos. So I don't know what about this God, you know. I thought I had this idea of God. But my sponsor said, you know, I want you to get on your knees and ask God to direct your day and then get on your knees at night and thank him for keeping you clean and sober that day. Can you do that? And I said, yeah. And a couple days later, he said, "How's that praying coming?" I said, "Man, I ain't doing that." He said, "What do you mean?" I said, "I've tried that stuff. It doesn't work for me." And he said, "Hoss, what do you got to lose?" And so I started saying, getting on my knees and saying a few prayers every morning and every night just to get Buff off my back. I mean, he was a proactive sponsor. And I'm grateful for that because I still do that. Maybe that's the reason I'm up here. I don't know. So I start these simple prayers, and next thing I know, I feel something. And so my prayers get longer, and they get more eloquent and flowing. And next thing I know, I got this whole laundry list of things for God to do every day. And I just start laughing. I said, "Hey, God, I'm conning you. You know, I'm doing your job." You know. So most of my prayers are just show me the right thing to do. I say the third step prayer and the seventh step prayer every morning and then get on my knees and try to do God's will that day. And at night, I thank him for keeping me clean and sober and faithful to my wife. So I've got this relationship with God. I didn't like the third step prayer because it had a bunch of these and thous and wilts in it. So I retyped it in modern English. That's the way I said it. So I'm rocking along on the first three steps, and I'm going to meetings, and I've learned all this lingo and in the meetings, and I just love AA, and I'm meeting all these friends, and plus all the stuff that's going wrong in our house, I can run off to a meeting and get away from for an hour, and I hate that. I hate that I have to tell you that, but it's the truth. And another thing is, anybody here that's new, there was a time where my family wanted more of me early on. Because I did spend a lot of time in meetings. And at the time, I really didn't like that I was away from my family. Instead of being at the bar all the time, I was at a meeting all the time. And I neglected my wife and my sons, particularly the first year. But I've been able to make up for that since then. I've been able to make amends for that. And if I hadn't have taken that time to go to any length, just like the theme of this convention, if I hadn't gone any length, I wouldn't be alive. And they wouldn't have the father and the husband that they have today that's available. It was a hard decision, but that's what I had to do for my recovery. So I'm rocking along for about a couple of months, and I start reading in the book that we get rigorously honest, we share in a general way, and we make amends to people. And this guilt and remorse that I have over cheating on my wife is eating my lunch. And I decide that I need to make amends to my wife. And I don't tell my sponsor about it because I'm sure the book says that's what you do. And I get her in a conversation one night and I told her in a general way that I'd been unfaithful to her and that I wasn't going to do that anymore and that I was going to be a better husband. And I really thought I was making amends to her for being honest. And if anybody out here is thinking about doing that, please see me after the meeting. Because when I told my sponsor what I'd done, he went, "Well, I can't tell you what he told me. I can't tell you. I'm trying to keep it clean up here." But he said, that's why they number the steps for smart college boys like you, is essentially what he said. He said, "You're not on the ninth step. You ain't even done a fourth step." And he said, beside that, Hoss, you didn't make amends to your wife. All you did was dump your guilt. And when he told me that, I realized that's what I had done. I felt so bad. That's when I really hit my bottom and became teachable. Because he was right, and I never thought that. You know, I think I can read this book and go through it and apply this stuff in my life, and having a sponsor is the easier, softer way. You know, he's an English-to-English interpreter. You know, he can shine the light for me in the dark where I can't shine it for me. I can shine it for other guys, but I don't shine it for me too well. That's why I still have a sponsor. So I got teachable. So I start, and I got so uncomfortable after going to meetings and for 10 and a half months and living off the first three steps and being wonderful, I was ready to just blow my brains out or drink again or start writing a four-step. I even went to my home group one night, and I told Steve's gone. They had to leave. Steve's old sponsor, Frank, was in the meeting one night, and I said, you know, I think the promises are coming true for me even though I'm just on the third step. And I said that in front of Frank, and he said, don't get too well too quick. You're doing the alcoholic waltz. And I said, what's that, Frank? He said, 1, 2, 3, drunk. 1, 2, 3, drunk. I thought, you old goat, what do you know? You ain't even been to treatment. I really thought I was better than I was. So at any rate, I get desperate enough to write a four-step, and my sponsor took me right through the book. I listed my resentments, all the people I hated and what they'd done to me, how it affected me, those first three columns. It was so easy to write that because I think I'm a victim anyway. You know, I'm a people pleaser, and I do these things, and then people turn on me. But then I wrote in that fourth column all the mistakes I'd written in there. And when I wrote that, I might as well just throw the other three columns away, because what that did was give me a blueprint for how I'd live my life, not how I had wanted you to think I was or pretend I was. It's how I'd live my life and how I treated people, and I hated seeing what I'd done there. I wrote a fears list. It said we wrote our fears in black and white, so I list my fears. And it says we ask ourselves why we had the fears, so I write all these elaborate reasons why I have these fears I had. And just writing them down helped, because before then all these fears were bouncing loose in my head. But when I did this written inventory, I could put them on paper for the first time and see what I was afraid of. But when I wrote all that, all my explanations, that's just a drunk trap, because the next sentence in the book says, wasn't it because self-reliance failed us? And I looked at all my explanations and realized that I'd gone through life trying to be my own higher power home group and sponsor all rolled into one, and I'm going to shoot my way out of any predicament I get in. And I was afraid of everything. I did a sex inventory. I try to remember every relationship I had, from a one-night stand to long-term relationship, including my wife of 15 years at the time. I was married to Diane 15 years when I got sober. And I might as well have just written one story of how I treated women and then put all the names in it, because I didn't know how to have a relationship. It was all selfish and self-centered. They started the same way. I would trade with you. I would buy you things. It's all about making me look good. Look who I've got with me and all that stuff. And all that failed. And then I'd go get another one. I thought, man, this is doomed, because by this time I'd already tried making amends, I thought, to Diane. And I'm thinking, I told Buff, I said, this is never going to work. He said, well, why don't you keep moving forward with the steps and let God sort that out? So then he said, okay, we're going to do a fifth step. Come to my house on Saturday morning. He read me the part in the book that said that invariably we got drunk if we kept secrets. And he said, I want you to admit to God and yourself and to me all the things that you don't want anybody to know. So I start writing these things down where I wouldn't forget them, all these things that I thought I'd go to the grave with. And some of them I wrote in code, so if somebody found a piece of paper, they wouldn't know what it meant. So I go over to his house, and he invites God in the room. And he said, the very first thing, he said, what's the worst thing on your list? And I looked down at the code, and I told him something that I was really ashamed of. And instead of saying, man, you're really sick, get out of here, he told me the worst thing that was on his fifth step. Now, here's a guy that loved me enough to tell me his deepest, darkest secret, to help me empty this garbage can I had in here of getting out. And so that made it easier. So I went through this process for quite a while. A couple of times he said, okay, is there anything else? And I looked down at the code, and there were some other things on there that I didn't tell him. But I thought, well, that's sort of like this other stuff. You know, that's the same stuff. So I didn't tell him everything. And he asked me a couple of times. And then after that, he said, well, go, you know, the book says that you go for an hour and review what you've done. So I go start out to my office, and I get about a block from his house, and all of a sudden it dawns on me that I didn't tell him everything. And it scared me to death. And I picked up my phone, and I called him, and I said, Buff. And before I called him, it dawned on me that a guy that I was going to meetings with that couldn't get sober, he would stay sober a while, then he'd get drunk. And about a couple days before I did my fifth step, he said that he had done a fifth step and left something out, and he got drunk, and he had picked up another white chip that week. And for the first time, I thought, you know, if that guy left a secret out and got drunk, and if I really think I'm a real alcoholic, if I really think I'm the real deal, I got to do what everybody does or I'm going to get drunk. You know, I don't get to do this stuff cafeteria style. So I called Buff and I said, look, man, I left something out. And he starts laughing. And I'm sweating because I don't want to tell him this garbage, and I hate to admit that I lied to my sponsor. And I said, why are you laughing? He said, well, man, you know, usually it takes a couple of hours before they call back. You're easy. He said, what is it? So I told him this stuff. And he said, man, I love you anyway. And none of us get here because, you know, I don't know about you. I didn't come here walking toward the light. I came here running from the fire. And so I had all these skeletons in my closet. And I've got to tell a lot of men, I love you anyway. It's so freeing. It's that's as close to doing God's work as I ever feel, of listening to another person's fifth step and help them get through that garbage and build a new life. So I go to my office, and I read steps 6 and 7, you know, became entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character and humbly ask him to remove my shortcomings. And I'm going, 2 steps, 2 paragraphs, boom, boom, finally, after all this sweat and bullets. So I think I've done that. But what I did was, the next couple of months, I thought, you know, I know how I've loused up my life by writing this inventory. I'm just not going to be that way anymore. And what I found out was that I was untreated alcoholism was kicking me again, because I was angry, I was restless, I was getting depressed again. It came to a head on a family vacation at my in-law's house, where I cussed out my father-in-law on his boat after I'd been living in his house and eating his food for a week in the Florida Keys. And then I went on back to the house and yelled at both my sons, who young guys, they were rambunctious at Christmas time. And I just felt awful. And I called my sponsor and I said, man, I just cussed out my father-in-law. I don't even know why. And I yelled at my kids. You know, I just feel awful. And he said, congratulations, Hoss. You've been trying to remove your own character defects. He said, why don't you get on your knees and say the 7th step prayer like you mean it, and then let's get busy on these amends. Well, after I loused up my amends to my wife, I just wrote the list of the people I'd harmed, wrote the harm that I'd caused him, and gave it to my sponsor, and I said, please help me with this. And that's one of the best things I ever did, is get his guidance and experience. Now, one of the things he told me, suggested that I do, well, no, he told me. He said there's suggestions for most people, and he said, for you, Michael, it's damn well better. But I want to tell you about a few of those men. Number one, the amends to my wife. Buff was about 2 years sober when he was my sponsor, and the best interpretation of the literature, he gave me an amends to make to my wife. And I wrote her a letter at his direction. And I gave the letter to my wife, and she read it and tore it up in front of me. It wasn't acceptable to her. And I was just devastated, and of course she was too. And I said, what do I do now? He said, that's the best we can do right now. And that was his best thinking, which was much better than what I did the first time, you know? And I really thought, well, I'll just make living amends to her, and as I'm a good husband and a good father, that'll go away. Well, we got along pretty good. You know, Diane had every right to leave me several times, and she didn't. And I'm so grateful that she stayed. But about 5.5 years later, after I tried to make this real amends to her, one of our sons got in some difficulty, and we went to see a family counselor. And Buff told me, he said, you're going to find out this just about you and Diane. And sure enough, we were not in there 5 minutes, and all that came up. And through going to this counselor, we got some information about how to deal with this and what I need to do to make amends to her that were satisfactory. And so I told my sponsor that information, and he said, well, are you willing to make that amends to her? I said, no, I don't think it'll work. And he said, what do you think's the worst can happen? I said, I think she'll leave me. He said, well, do you think you could stay sober if she did? That's all he wanted to know. I said, yeah, but I don't want that. He said, well, she deserves that amends. That's what she wants. And so I made that amends to her. And I didn't think it would work. But that was 19 years ago last December. I wouldn't trade my marriage with anybody. I love you. So that's how that went. My father had this resentment against my dad, but he'd try to help me every way he could, but he drank like I did. And my mother passed away before I got sober, and all I could do was stay drunk in the funeral home. And that's the best I could do, and just stay numb. But my dad was living by himself, and I had to take his car keys away from him. I was talking to Jason about this earlier. You know, when I do the right thing, I think I'm supposed to feel warm and fuzzy, and sometimes I do the right thing and I feel terrible. And one of them was I had to take my dad's car keys away from him when he started having some accidents. My sisters were out of town, and I was the one to do that. And I'll never forget the look he gave me, but it was the right thing to do. It was a sober decision. But my dad lived in an assisted living, and I had to drive him around. And I made amends to him, wrote him a letter, and thanked him for all the things he'd done for me, and that I was trying to be the son he always wanted. And we got along okay, and then we didn't get along. And we'd argue on these trips where I'd take him around. He'd tell me how to drive, and we'd cuss each other out and all that. And I'd call my sponsor crying and saying, I don't get this, you know. I made amends to this guy, and I'm just not getting along with him. He said, you know, there's some more inventory you probably need to do there. And so I had to do some 10-step work on that. And what I found out was that my dad was a guy that had some wealth and influence, and I always wanted that. Now, at this time, I'm 40 years old. I've been making my own living for a long time without his aid. But I still had that friction between him because I wanted what he had. It was my greed. And Buff said, I said, this is finally what it is, Buff. He said, well, that's easy. He said, just get on your knees and pray every night for 3 weeks that when he dies, he leaves everything to your sisters. And I thought he was nuts, but I was in a lot of pain, so I did it. And I got along with him pretty well. I used to say I didn't get along with my dad at all, but the truth of the matter is he passed away not long after that, and we ran out of time. You know, I wish I'd have got to spend some sober time with him. We'd had a lot better relationship, and I have fond memories of my dad today. Okay, I'm going to tell you about Mr. Logan again, about my next-door neighbor. You know, Buff said, you know, when you make amends to somebody, you don't just go tell them you're sorry. They know what a sorry son of a gun you are. He said, you try to repair the damage you've caused, or you stay willing. And I've got a couple of amends to this day that I can't make, that I'd love to make, but it would cause further harm, so I can't do it. But he said, Mr. Logan, he said, that's easy. He said, you need to go to him, you need to apologize to him, and you need to plant him another weeping cherry tree. He said, now, you don't need to tell him you know how it died. That wouldn't add anything to it. He doesn't know that. That'd cause further harm. And I don't know about you guys, but when I get an amend put in my face that I've got to do, those people just kind of appear, and I was coming back from Steve's home group, the back room group, one Sunday morning, a couple days after Buff told me what to do. And I pulled in my driveway, and there he is out there on his riding lawnmower. And my heart really started pounding, and I stopped. I just said, God, I don't know what I'm supposed to do or say here. Please give me the right words to say and the power to carry this out. And I get out of my truck, and I walked around the 6-foot-high wood fence that I put up to try to screen him out after he sued me. And I'm walking over to him, and he's on this riding lawnmower, and he sees me coming, and I can see his eyes. And they're wide, and he's afraid of me. He's really afraid of me. And he has this look on his face like, you know, do I need to get this lawnmower in a high enough gear to outrun this guy or abandon ship and run? I mean, But he turned the lawnmower off, and I walked over to him. And I said, Mr. Logan, can I talk to you for a minute? He said, sure, what is it? I said, I did a terrible thing cutting your trees down years ago, and I've been disrespectful to you and your wife for a long time, and all that was wrong. I wish I hadn't done that. And I'm trying to change some things in my life, and I don't know, I'm trying to straighten up some of my wreckage. Now, I don't know what I could ever do to straighten out the damage I've caused you, but if there's anything I can do to repair that damage, I'm willing to do it. Now, I didn't mean to say that. I really didn't. But I asked God to direct what came out of my mouth, and that's what I said. And I really thought the guy would say, well, just get off my property and don't you ever come back. Don't come near me again, because that's the way I was. I'd burn people off, you know, get out of my life. That's how I was. And I expected that. And if he had requested that, I would have honored that, because sometimes we hurt people beyond their capacity to love us. But instead, he came over to me and he put his arms around me and he started hugging me and he started crying on my shoulder. This man was 80 years old at this time. And he hugged me and he was sobbing. And I didn't know what to do. That was the last thing I expected. And he held me for a while, and then he pulled back away from me, and he looked me right in the eye. And he said, what's in the past is over. He just forgave me, just like that. Now I'm thinking, okay, he's forgiven you. Run. I mean, I wanted to run away. I'm a fight or flight guy, and I mean, this was run time, because I didn't know how to handle this. Now, that's my best thinking. That's my best thinking. If I hadn't had clear instructions from my sponsor, I would have missed what I'm going to tell you now. If I would have run away, I would have my story just stop right here. But I could hear Buff saying, you got stuff to do here. And I said, I really appreciate you forgiving me. I said, but I really want to do something to make up for the damage I've caused you. And that's when he said, you already have. He said, the thing that hurt us the most all these years is that we've lost our neighbor. And my wife and I have been praying all these years that we'd get our neighbor back. And now our prayers have been answered. When I've been cussing him every day, he'd been praying for me. My sponsor told me couple years ago, he said, you know, if you ever get to where your higher power is not big enough, why don't you just borrow Mr. Logan's for a while? I said, well, thank you, but I really want to do something to make up for what the damage I caused. And he said, you already have by coming over here. I said, well, I noticed your cherry tree died over there. Could I plant you another tree? And he said, oh, you don't have to do that. And I said, well, I'd like to if you'll let me. And I didn't have my people anymore at that point. But my son, who was 12 at the time, he and I went and got a bigger weeping cherry tree, and we planted that thing in his yard. And I got a letter I carried in my big book that I never thought I'd get to read this, but I have for a lot of folks. And this is June 26, 1991. Dear Mike, it was with much surprise that we found a beautiful cherry tree in our yard when we returned home yesterday. We had not expected it so soon. We appreciate it so very much, and we will care for it, and we will cherish it always, not only for its own sake, for it is a beautiful tree, but because it symbolizes a deep and lasting friendship between us and you and your family. We pray that God will bless you and your family and all that you do, and we pray for ourselves, for we are sinful people by nature. There are none of us without fault, and we need his constant love and forgiveness. Again, we thank you for the tree. We're all the more grateful that because you did not have to do it. Your friendship means more to us than you know, most sincerely. George Logan. That's for you, Mr. Logan. It's not for me. I'd have gone to the grave hating this guy if I hadn't been desperate enough to get my life together and listen to a sponsor. You know, after that, I started knowing a new freedom and a new happiness. You know, I've seen people make amends halfway through the amends step, and their life, they get the promises whether they want them or not. You know, this man gave us a country ham every year for Christmas, every year until he died after that. The first flowers that came to the funeral home when my dad died a year later was a wreath of purple orchids from Mr. Logan, and I've still got one of them on my desk at home. You know, he passed away a couple years later, and you guys have taught me to show up for funerals and weddings and graduations that I used to be too busy for. And I go to this Baptist church, and I'm going through this visitation line. I don't know any of these people there, but I'm just there to show up. And I shake hands with this one guy, and he said, oh, you're Mr. Allison. Dad told us about you. And I'm going, uh-oh. And this man said that y'all had had a disagreement, but that you'd made it right. And you see, I didn't make it right. I'd have gone to the grave hating that man. But because I was desperate enough to do something about my alcoholism and take the steps, just because I didn't have anything else to do, I love being out of ideas. That's the best time of my life is when I'm out of ideas and a follow what somebody else tells me. So our lives get good after that. You know, I've got step 10 to stay current. I got step 11 to get to know this God as, gosh, keeps changing for me. And the 12th step, I just get to try to practice this in all my affairs and try to give it away. So we're doing great. Several years go down the road. I'm in AA, and Diane's in Al-Anon. Our kids are in Al-Teen. We're in Al-Dog and Al-Cat and everything you can do. I mean, we're just the recovery family. And all of a sudden, I get a phone call in the middle of the day and said, we caught your son. He's an eighth grader in middle school. He said, we caught your son with some marijuana, and we have zero tolerance, and he's out of school for a year. Come get him right now. And I'm thinking, you don't understand. We're the recovery family. This ain't going to happen to us. And I was really angry, and I picked up my son, and he struggled off and on with drugs since then. I don't know whether he'll ever get to this room or not, but, you know, my sponsor told me one time, he said, you know, you never did anything your father told you to do, did you? I said, no, I usually did the opposite. He said, but you watched what he did, didn't you? I said, yeah. And he said, well, your sons are watching you. There's a lot of people watching you. But I get my son, and we had a hard time finding a place for him to go in the middle of the year because we couldn't get him in a private school, another private school. You know, you get kicked out of a public school for drugs, private school is really not happy to have you. So at the last minute, we get him into an alternative learning center. And it was on the other side of town from where this sod farm was that I operated at the time. And so I had to leave work a little after lunch and drive all the way into town, across town, pick him up within a 5-minute window at this alternative learning center from 5 till 2 to 2 o'clock every day for a year, and either take him to our house in South Nashville or all the way out to my sod farm out in the west part of the county. And I thought, is this my reward, you know, for staying sober? You know, my kid gets kicked out of drugs, and now I got to leave work and work extra hours and all this kind of stuff. But you know what that did for me? It forced me to spend time with my son that I wouldn't have done because I worked all the time. You know, I got to know my son that year on a level that's priceless. He's 33 now, and I have a bond with him that I got because I had to pick him up every day and spend time with him. So I never know what God puts in front of me that I think is a burden turns out to be gold. One other thing, I'll close it. My sponsor contracted a disease when I was 10 and a half years sober, and it slowly killed him over a year. And a lot of people are saying, when Buff leaves, who are you going to get for a sponsor? And I just put him off. As long as Buff's alive, he's my sponsor. Because this man spent hours and hours and hours. He loved me so much more than anybody that I've ever known outside of my wife. He was the first person I ever learned to trust, you know, which helped me open the door to carry my recovery with other people. And so as Buff's dying, I was having a hard time with it. But he finally passed away. And I'm 10 and a half years sober. And a couple of guys came up to me at his funeral and said, what are you going to do now? And I just put them off. I said, well, I don't know right now. Well, then I had this conversation in my head. It went sort of like this. Hey, man, you're 10 and a half years sober. You've been through the steps. Your life's good. You know, your business is doing good. You know, your family's doing good. You know what Buff would tell you anyway. You probably don't need to get another sponsor. And I thought, that is nuts. You know, I have alcoholism. I don't have alcoholism. So I pick up the phone and I call Terry, the guy that had to sleep with a pint of vodka. And he was a guy that he got sober 6 months before I did, and I rode his coattails through the steps because I saw him taking action and saw his life changing. So he was an inspiration to me. So I called Terry and I said, look, I just had this conversation in my head that I don't need to get another sponsor, and that's crazy. Will you be my sponsor? He said, yeah, but I'm not Buff. And I'm so grateful that he said that because, you see, I have this contempt prior to investigation. I think I know what I need all the time. I thought I needed another guy like Buff, and there'll never be anybody like Buff again. But Terry's now been my sponsor much longer than Buff was. And he's a wonderful man. He's my rock in recovery. He's taught me how to live one day at a time, you know, just do Sunday things on Sunday. He's taught me how to be a husband and a father and a grandfather. and a friend and a better person. And what I didn't know, though, when I take action, I think it's all about me. But he was having the same conversation in his head that he didn't need to get another sponsor too. So after I called him, he picked up the phone and called another guy and said, you know, I wasn't going to get another sponsor, but Allison said, that's crazy. Will you be mine? So I get to pass stuff on, and I don't even know I'm passing it on sometimes. I've had a wonderful time this weekend. I just want to close by reading the bottom of page 152. How's that to come about, you ask? Where am I to find these people? You're going to meet these new friends in your own community. Near you, alcoholics are dying helplessly like people in a sinking ship. If you live in a large place, there are hundreds, high and low, rich and poor. These are future fellows of Alcoholics Anonymous. Among them, you will make lifelong friends. You will be bound to them with new and wonderful ties, and you will escape disaster together, and you will commence shoulder to shoulder your common journey. Then you will know what it means to give of yourself that others may survive and rediscover life. You will learn the full meaning of love thy neighbor as thyself. Thank you so much for a great weekend, and thank you so much for listening. I love you.